So I think for many people, this is the heart of the subject of the study of integral quantum field theories. I personally find this part of the theory pretty difficult to understand because it's entirely non-perturbative. So it's very, very difficult to get your hands on it. But I'll do my best to explain the parts I do understand. So, we're going to continue to work in two dimensions, but now in Lorentzian signature. So we're going to assume we have a massive theory. So this means that the Hilbert space is localized in space. So the Hilbert space is built from particles which are localized in space. So we'll assume that our theory has some symmetry group, say SU2 for simplicity. And we'll assume, as before, we'll explain in more detail in a minute, that this extends to Yangian symmetry, just given by the monotomy matrices that we discussed several times. So what does this mean? So because the theory is massive, there's going to be a piece of the Hilbert space, which is the single particle Hilbert space, which is localized near, say, a line in space-time or a point in space. So the types of particles they're described by some mass m and by their spin, not under the Lorentz group, under this double symmetry. If we were in a dimension bigger than 2, when we talk about massive particles, we would start thinking about representations of the little group. This old Wigner way of thinking about what a particle is. But in dimension 2, that there's nothing there. There's no little group. So the representations of the SU2 global symmetry are labeled by the spin. The spin is some j, which is some integer, half integer. Okay, so so when this gets, when such a particle is at rest, it has 2 momentum. And 0, but more generally, I can hit this with the Lorentz boost. So in 2 dimensions, The Lorentz group is very simple. So Lorentz boosts look like this. They're like 2x2 matrices like this, where I have cosh and sinh. So this is just the analog of the familiar 2x2 rotation matrices, where cosine has been replaced by hyperbolic cosine and so on. And theta is a parameter called rapidity. So rapidity is the Lorentzian analog of the angle at which a particle travels, because it's just obtained from an angle going just in time and rotating it. And then we find the momentum is m cosh theta minus m sinh theta. So the kind of thing we're interested in is, suppose we have, say, some number of particles coming in, say two, with certain masses, spins, and rapidities. They're going to scatter off each other and produce some other number of particles.
Question?
Yeah.
By spin, do you mean isospin in this case?
Yes, that's your two global symmetry spin, yes. Suppose we have, say, two particles of masses mi, spins, the SU2 spins, ji, and at rapidities pi, then they can come in, and in principle, they can scatter. To produce some number of particles. Of say, of some spins, say theta I prime, or rapidities, masses mi prime, rapidities theta I prime, and spins j prime. Now, there's some constraints on this. There's some obvious constraint of conservation of momentum. But also, we should think about what the scattering process does to the internal states. Because each particle transforms in some representation of SU2, I can think of, at the end of these lines, I have some state which lives in that representation. And as I go from here to here, I find an operator which takes states down here to states down there. That operator is the scattering matrix. So if Vj is equal to the spin J representation of SU2, then the scattering matrix is S from the incoming guys these are the incoming So this scattering matrix, because everything is symmetric under SU2, this must be an intertwiner. Now, of course, S also depends on all these other parameters, like the mass and the rapidity, but I'm not including that into the notation.
So what is an intertwiner?
Right, so that... let me write it out explicitly. I'm not sure what people's math background is. So it just means it plays nicely with the way the SU2 generators act on each side. So if rho A are the SU2 generators, then S of like on the left hand side, the SU2 generators act on one guy at a time, and this must be the same as the corresponding expression on the right hand side. So it's a homomorphism of SU2 representations. Okay, so the goal in the study of these two-dimensional theories is to, you know, find what the scattering matrix is. So the main claim in this subject is that in an integrable theory, there is no particle production. Can people see this part of the blackboard?
The lower part, I think, is a bit harder to see.
Okay. So that is... what does it mean having no particle production is that if two particles come in, with SU2 spins and rapidities and masses, say J1, M1, theta1, this then two particles go out with the same and so then two particles with the same data So similarly, if three particles come in, three particles come out, so on. So any questions about this? So this is a kind of remarkable feature. In a Lorentz invariant theory, this can only happen in two dimensions unless your theory is free. So this is something that's very special to the study of theories in two space-time dimensions. But this property does not imply your theory is free, because the scattering matrix going from here to here might be some non-trivial matrix. And that can and it will happen. It will turn out that the scattering matrix, in some cases, will be the Ohr matrix we studied right at the beginning. Okay, so why would we expect to have such a crazy and unusual property for scattering of particles? So for some authors, this will be the definition of what they mean to be integrable. For other authors, they might take their definition of integrable to be there's a conserved current of spin bigger than 2. And then there's an argument of Witten that shows that in that situation, you can't have particle production. And for us, we're going to take our definition of integrable to be related to these extra symmetries given by the monodromy matrix. And we'll argue that, we sort of sketch an argument that in the presence of these extra symmetries, you can't have particle production. So to show this, we'll need to introduce the monodromy matrix in these models. So in perturbation theory, we defined the monodromy matrix as a path ordered exponential of the Lax operator. So non-perturbatively, we don't have a real hands-on definition of what the non-perturbative theory is. So we're just going to assume that the perturbative monodromy matrix kind of extends analytically in some way and ask that it has some formal properties which are natural properties that are easy to see in perturbation theory. So we will assume that the non-perturbative theory has a monodromy matrix MZIJ acting on the Hilbert space so with the following properties. So the first property we want is Well, the first property we want is actually something we didn't really see in the perturbative analysis, because it's something that is not visible classically. It appears at first order in the loop expansion. Let's see, so if we apply a Lorentz boost by theta, then this guy transforms to mij z plus theta. Let's say make a minus theta. Secondly, if we have a single particle at rest, in a representation of spin J, then the Mondrami matrix one over z times rho ij. Ah, spin. Sorry, poor notation. So then I want the Mondrami matrix. So it's A, B range from 1 to 2, so this is a 2 by 2 matrix. So the generators of SU2 act in the spin J representation by these matrices. I want it to be the matrix which acts in the spin J representation. Of SU2. And the third property . So for this property, I mean, this is kind of forced on us. It's just up to a transformation of Z, we can assume it has a single pole. I mean, there are very few possibilities for what it can be in a single particle representation. So in a two particle representation, of spins representation with particles 1, 2, then MAB . Let me draw a picture to illustrate this last one. This is, again, you should be familiar from our study of the Lax matrix. So if I have two particles, like that, and the Mondrami matrix I should visualize as a line crossing them, because in perturbation theory, the Mondrami matrix is given by integrating the Lax matrix along this line, and this line crosses the Wöhr lines of these particles, and it has some incoming states A and B. I want this to be the sum over the intermediate states like that. And clearly in the path ordered exponential of the Lax matrix, we saw something exactly like that. And in this case, nothing interesting can happen in this intermediate region because there's nothing going on. There's no particles there. Okay, so for this to be a symmetry of the theory, for the monodromy matrix, to be a symmetry, we must have M A B. If I do some scattering process, compose it with this guy, I must get the same thing. So here's an illustration of a scattering process. Imagine there was some particle production. Or a color chalk that we can have. And this must be equal to the same scattering process with the monodromy matrix on the other side. Now, if we expand the monodromy matrix in powers of 1 over z, we'll find that this is a very strong algebraic constraint on the properties the scattering matrix can have. And in good situations, I believe it can rule out particle production. Okay, any questions? And I hope that this discussion we're having here reminds you of what happened at the very beginning, right? Because once we have these massive particles, the continuum field theory is behaving more like a lattice or something like this. In the beginning, we had these lattice models with lines, and we had the monodromy matrix from things crossing those lines. It's exactly the same. Yes.
Can you clarify a bit the two?
Pardon?
Can you clarify a bit the topic two?
Can I explain why?
Yeah, I mean, why we're taking the matrix to have that form?
Right, well, since the whole theory is SU2 symmetry, that the monodromy matrix must transform in the adjoint representation of SU2. Now, the only matrices now in the spin J representation, the only matrices I can write down which transform in the adjoint representation are the usual ones. So it must be some function of Z times those matrices.
Question is why the function of Z is 1 over Z?
Right. You can see why a factor of 1 over z must be present by looking at the form of the Lax matrix. In perturbation theory, the Lax matrix was 1 over z times j plus 1 over 1 minus z times the other current. So expanding in powers of 1 over z, the coefficient of 1 over z of the Lax matrix was the current. So we saw in perturbation theory, the coefficient of 1 over z in the monodromy matrix was just given by the SU2 action. So that seems very reasonable to assume that this continues to hold. The question then is why is it not a more complicated function? This is not a super satisfactory answer, but you can show. I mean, of course, I didn't write it down. One of the properties, if you want the monodromy matrix to have, is that it must satisfy the algebra we wrote down many times, this RTT relation. This RTT relation strongly constrains those coefficients. And by analyzing the representation theory of this algebra, you can show that up to a shift, up to a translation of Z, this is the only possibility.
You remember that last week we had all those many family of solutions of young Bach's there with different dependencies on Z and stuff?
Yes, those they all break SUT symmetry. Yeah, so maybe I didn't. Does this answer your question? To a degree. So let me write down this important property that I forgot to write. So as before, monodromy matrix. So this relation we wrote down several times, so I won't expand it out. So I think the thing I'd like to do now is to try to analyze the coefficient of 1 over z squared in the monodromy matrix and get some idea why this might exclude particle production. I must say, at this point, this is not the standard way to show why there's no particle production. But for me, the way I think about integrable systems, I feel the monodromy matrix is a very central object. So I want to argue this way. Not all details have been very carefully worked out in this argument. So suppose we have say two particles of spin 1/2 and rapidities theta 1, theta 2, then the Hilbert space for this sector so this is by v^2 I mean the spin half representation of SU2. So it's a four-dimensional space. The monodromy matrix just for the individual particles is 1 over z minus theta I rho a b. So using the formula for how the monodromy matrix must act when I have the two particles, MABZ. Ah, sorry, I'm really sorry, I forgot. It should be plus delta AB, sorry about that. That was a stupid mistake. This happens, you know, when we have the Lax matrix, the leading term is there's no interaction between them, and the next term is this one. This happened in the spin system too, but I just forgot this term here. So the Monterey matrix looks like delta AB plus 1 over Z minus AC, sorry. Theta 1 rho AC. So I put a subscript 1 to indicate it's acting on the first factor.
So, uh-huh. In the board up there, there should be a delta there, right? When you say monodromy matrix for the individual part.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry.
There should be a plus delta as well.
Plus delta B, sorry about that. Okay, so expanding this out, we find delta AB plus 1 over Z minus theta 1 rho AB first guy plus 1 over Z minus theta 2 rho AB on the second factor plus a kind of mixed term where I have something acting on one particle and something acting on the other particle. So if we expand Mij of z in powers, so Mab of z in powers of 1 over z, you'll find, as is clear in this example, delta AB plus 1 over Z times rho AB1 plus rho AB2. So this factor here, the coefficient of 1 over Z, would be the usual action of the SU2 generators. Like when I have two particles, I take an SU2 generator, it acts on one, or it acts on the other, and I take the sum of them both. But the interesting term would be the one with the 1 over z squared. Here I find theta 1 So these are this is the usual action. These are the next level, some extra symmetries. Okay, so let's see.
When you say they give vectors, is that only because of the thing you're rubbing at the time?
That they must commute with the or matrix, the S matrix? Exactly, yes. So the statement that MIABZS is equal to SMABZ, well, when expanded in powers of 1 over z, becomes firstly the zeroth order z to the zero. This is just a trivial statement. Z to the minus one. This becomes the statement that S is an SU2 intertwiner. So that one we already had. This just means our theory is SU2 symmetry, so it's nothing new. And z to the minus two. An interesting new constraint on S. So when I was preparing this, I like some factor wrong, and like through the example I had worked out of this. Didn't quite work as I had hoped. So I want to think of another example to see concretely why this is an interesting constraint on S. Okay, so I'll give you an example which is like slightly unphysical, but easy where the algebra is quite easy. Suppose I had two particles of spin one which are compatible, which form a bound state of spin one. Okay. So two particles come in, one particle leaves, everything is spin one to this double SU2. I suppose can possibly happen. There is some SU2 symmetric way of doing this. There's there is a unique up to scale SU2 symmetric map S V1 tensor V2 to V1. So the S matrix is determined up to scale. So we would like to determine the rapidities. So we do this by looking at the coefficient of 1 over z squared in the monotropy matrix before and after the scattering and seeing what that is. So we'll say, assume by Lorentz boost, we can assume that this guy is 0. And the rapidity here is theta 1, rapidity here is theta 2. And what is the coefficient of c to the minus 2 before the scattering is, we look at that formula. Okay, so after scattering, because we normalize so that this guy is at 0, by Lorentz boost, it's 0. So we must have the scattering matrix times theta 1 well, this guy is equal to 0. So how do we do this? Well, firstly, Because this is an SU2 intertwiner, if I take rho there plus rho there, it's equal to rho there. So I can write this as, this part is theta 1 rho AB1 plus rho AB2 plus theta 2 minus theta 1 rho AB2. What am I saying? Hold on a second. Man, I have done this calculation so many times. Sorry, my my Lie theory is deserting me in front of the blackboard temporarily. Because this is the spin one representation, it's also the adjoint representation of SU2. And this unique vertex is the commutator FABC. So what's really happening here is like FABC. And when I act with a current, the symmetry there, that's also given by the commutator. So you can use algebra which the first two terms are something like a multiple of rho AB acting on the outgoing. And the third term because this is the this is the bilocal term, I get this term where I contract the bilocal term with FABC. If you work out what it is, it's this quantity we were referring to as the Joule-Coxeter number. So it's again some other multiple of rho AB. This implies a linear equation. By which theta can be fixed. I'm sorry I wasn't able to bring all of this argument to mind. There's like a very extensive discussion of exactly this kind of thing in a paper I have with Witten and Yamazaki. Okay, but I hope that you guys can at least sort of see why this extra relation gives quite a strong constraint in the possibilities of the scattering matrix. And I believe that if you work hard, you can show that it's not possible to produce any particles by using a good understanding of the representation theory of this algebra. In the last 5 minutes, we've understood these extra symmetries and what scattering is, and we believe, at least vaguely, that there should be no particle production. The last 5 minutes, I wanted to explain why, given that there's no particle production, yet the scattering matrix itself must satisfy the Young-Baxter equation. So, consider the three scattering. Like this. So, because of the absence of particle production, yeah.
Sorry, I'm very confused there.
Sorry, yeah.
Why aren't theta 1 and theta 2 fixed by energy momentum conservation? If theta 3.
Well, I didn't tell you what the masses of the particles were.
Given the masses. So
yes.
That's it. Okay.
Yeah. So, another way to say this. Because they might not all be the same particle, right? They might live in the same representation of SU2. If we assume the two incoming particles are the same mass, then theta 2 must equal to minus theta 1. Right? So then we're left with one linear equation to fix, which this symmetry fixes. So this is another argument I learned from Witten, but I don't really understand it in my bones somehow. Maybe I'll have to go over it again next time. So if there is no particle production, then the 3-to-3 particle scattering must be localized as the product, as the composition of the 2-to-2 scattering. It's because if there was particle production, there could be stuff happening in the middle. And, you know, particle production, you might have things like that. A particle is appearing and then disappearing somewhere in the middle of this diagram. With no particle production, that just can't happen. So this guy only depends on the 2-to-2 scattering, 2-to-2 scattering, 2-to-2 scattering. Now, this can have no discontinuities. As I vary 3-to-3, it can have no discontinuity, so I can move it over here. That's the Young-Baxter equation. You can assume by taking the angles that the rapidity is generic, this can't happen. Right?
Sorry.
Can't you assume by taking the rapidities to be generic that that can't happen? What am I saying? You know what? This point, I must say, I don't understand as well as I'd like. Like this whole subject of, you know, scattering of massive particles is a bit far from my base area of expertise, and I'm trying to learn it more. So why don't I read the relevant paper and try to explain it in more reasonable terms tomorrow?